We're here to make a dent in the universe, or else why are we even doing this?
If I don't think I cut out all the fun stuff, because that to me is the fun stuff.
Build that audience, because if you've got no one to sell it to, then it's just going to flop and die, and no one likes a floppy, right?
I'm yet to meet a woman who just kind of grew up confidently in her body.
Welcome to my podcast. I'm Nicole Brumner. Join my weekly conversations with really interesting people as I delve into the stories and experiences that make them uniquely them. Welcome back to another Drastic Talks with me, Nicole Brumner. I'm a property developer and investor in a number of prop tech and other startup companies. And with me today is Ben Lerner. Now, Ben is an industry veteran, and that is a real estate tech veteran of nearly two decades within this space. And looking at his LinkedIn, you can just see the wealth of knowledge that he has in this space. So Ben, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Nicole.
Now, I thought your name looked familiar when it came up on my booking sheet for these talks. And then I realized that we had a conversation on Twitter about a rather different subject.
We absolutely did quite a while back. You and I think we'll be following each other. And yes, we did have I reacted to a cry for help.
My dishwasher had broken down. And I think I would prefer to wash clothes by hand than dishes. So yes, you came to my aid with a dishwasher repair person who I'll certainly keep on call for next time. So thank you very much. But today we're going to be talking about technology, and specifically real estate technology. So why don't you give us a rundown of what it is that you do?
Yeah, sure, no problem. And first, I just want to thank Drastic for bringing us together. As Nicole says, we have had contact. We did know of each other. We've spoken online, but this is a really good opportunity to actually speak to each other properly and hear a bit more about what I'm up to, and obviously to meet Nicole properly. My background is almost 20 years in real estate tech or prop tech, as it's often referred to. It's interesting that most people, when they hear the term prop tech, even those who are involved in prop tech, will say, oh yeah, prop tech, that's this new thing that cropped up 5, 6, 8 years ago as the transformation within the real estate industry took hold and people started getting their heads around tech. Actually, I've been in it for almost 20 years, and the company I started out with, which was a family business of ours, is now probably about 40 years old. So real estate tech, prop tech, is certainly not a new thing, but I've been involved about 20 years. So I joined our family business straight out of university with a tech and business degree. We did software for the real estate industry. So anything from property management solutions to high street agency solutions, facilities management solutions, and anything and everything in between. I was with the company for about 16 years, helped grow and lead the business, got involved in a number of acquisitions that we made and investments that we made along the way, all within the real estate tech space. And I sold that business in 2017 to one of the largest players in the space, MRI Software, a US company. Since selling the business to them, I stayed with them for a while to help integrate the business. And then actually thought, do you know what? I'd much rather work for myself than work for somebody else. It's not as much fun, even if you're doing the same job, it's not as much fun doing it for somebody else as it is doing it for yourself. And I thought, well, if I'd look at the things that I enjoy most, which is that blend of real estate, technology, and investment, the finance side of things, then, you know, let's go out and see if we can work on the investment side of real estate tech. Over the years, I'd spoken to a number of private equity firms that I knew. We'd always, had good relationships. We'd always spoken about the industry. So I was pretty sure that, you know, with a background in real estate and tech, and having done deals, on behalf of our business, a number of deals, probably 7 or 8 deals over the years, it'll be a doddle. Just call up the private equity firms that I know and have a great chat and, you know, walk into a job. Turns out that's not quite the case. The private equity world, much as we had a great relationships and they enjoyed our discussions together, and you know, they wanted to collaborate on deals and they were happy to see me as a consultant and to bring them deals and put money my way as well. But when I actually came down to a role in the investment team, because I didn't have the background, you know, the Harvard background, the analyst background, investment banking background, it was a case of, we really like you, we really like what you do, we'd love to work with you, and they do work with me, but we'll never take you on full time. And after a while, actually talking to these guys about, you know, deals that were out there, introducing various people to various deals, I thought, you know what, I could do this myself. And that's what I set out to do. So sat back, opened up my own M&A practice, focused purely on real estate tech. Given that I know the market, I know the potential buyers very well. I know the private equity firms looking to invest in the space well. And I know the companies and the owners and the founders who are potentially looking to exit their businesses. I spent all my time doing what I love. So talking to owners, talking to buyers, talking to sellers, working deals, helping negotiate, bring people together, and loving every minute of it. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. I would say that my experience in real estate tech is both operational, strategic, and more latterly in the financial side.
That's right. And you're not tied to anyone. You've got that independence, which is so great, especially now where we're in lockdown and you can assist with the family where needed and all around on your own time. But with
that, I would say most of that. I'm not sure about assisting with the family, but absolutely having gone from looking after, you know, huge teams, we were about 300 people when I sold the business. So having gone from looking after a business, looking after teams, I absolutely would much rather not have employees. You know, I enjoy, as you say, working on my own, or not quite on my own because I've got support behind me, but I enjoy you working on my own terms from home or pre-COVID traveling. So I'm not sure about the helping out the family, getting involved with the housework and stuff like that. But actually, I'm very much enjoying not having a boss and not having employees.
But you know who can fix a dishwasher if that's needed.
I absolutely, I know a lot of people who could do a lot of stuff around the house. It's just not
exactly
me.
No, that's right. Me either. It's interesting that you did mention that we think of prop tech as this relatively new industry. And certainly it was only in the last, I would say, 7 years that I had heard of it as a standalone industry. But as you said, anytime that software has entered the industry, that's when it became prop tech and this technology industry. Do you think it's because all these new terms have arisen for an industry that was just previously called software for real estate?
I don't know which came first, the term or the actual software and tech in the space, but I think that there was clearly a turning point where it became much, much more mainstream. Well, I'd say now in the last couple of years it's mainstream, but that point that you talk about 7, 6, 7, 8 years ago, whenever it was, there was a turning point. I think some of that came as a result of the 2008 crash. People started looking at systems and things like that, but very quickly the term prop tech came up and people started trying to define prop tech with, you know, paragraphs and lengthy sentences, when actually so far as I was concerned, prop tech is pretty much just any technology that helps the property industry. But it was quite amazing that for the biggest asset class in the world, which real estate is, it's been around, you know, people have been dealing in some form or another, whether it's owning, renting, buying, occupying property since time immemorial. And, you know, since for an asset class of that size, they were way back in their technology uptake. You know, people were doing deals on the back of the paper. They were just crunching numbers. I mean, you know yourself from the development world, you know, people just work things out and away they go, and they've got spreadsheets. Yeah, at the best of times, sometimes it's a piece of paper, files, and it got to a point, I think, when people weren't that busy in the crash, during the crash, and after the crash, where they thought there's going to be some kind of boom. Let's get our house in order. And at the same time, people who had lost their jobs and people who had, you know, been involved in property and unfortunately didn't have, you know, jobs or what to look forward to, they kind of took a step back and said, you know what, I'm not doing a huge amount. This will pass, but in the meantime, I've got ideas and ways on how I can fix this industry. And a lot of that was residential. You know, at some point in everybody's life, they've either owned, rented, lived in, or had, you know, taken a mortgage, taken insurance, or something to that effect. So everyone's got an idea of how to make that process better. And similarly on the commercial side, you know, a lot of people have been involved in commercial property in offices or industrial at some point. And, you know, people just got to a point where they said, look, we can do things better. And then investment started pouring in. So, you know, you had all those VCs and all the people who were involved generally with fintech, which was the thing for the previous 10 years. You know, fintech, you know, is still going strong, that's for sure. And it's still very much a favored asset class for investment for VCs. But, you know, they started getting in on the act. And there's, I wouldn't say there's been a seismic shift, but certainly there's been a huge focus on PropTech in the last few years. And those that straddle the two, the fintech, PropTech businesses, are definitely winning at the moment.
That's interesting, because I know from my involvement that a lot of companies that might traditionally fall under the PropTech have been trying to switch to the fintech, because it does sound a little... perhaps more stable in the eyes of investors potentially. Is that something that you're seeing, or you did say that sweet spot is sort of straddling both of those?
Yeah, I think there's so many investors who are in on the fintech act, and you know they've been doing it for 10, 12 years, if not more, really deep in fintech. And there are some you know, who focus purely on PropTech, or some that got involved in PropTech the last few years, but actually there's loads more in the fintech space. And I think just from an investment perspective, founders recognize that actually, if there's a financial element to what I'm doing, A, people understand it more, and B, there's a much wider pool of potential investors. So I think, you know, where there's a financial element, absolutely, you know, people try to prey on that. But actually more and more, there are people who are setting up venture funds, and people are setting up, you know, corporate VCs are popping up all over the place with a particular focus on PropTech. So I think even those that don't have a financial element and are focused purely on efficiencies or making a process better, or even a pinch point solution somewhere along the line of the property spectrum, I think they're seeing a lot more investment and a bigger pool of people. But definitely, you know, fintech is still a big thing. So those that do fit into that sweet spot have definitely got an added advantage. But I think as I speak, it's, you know, I'm talking about PropTech and fintech and some of the financials around that. It's important to remember that actually PropTech is quite a vast spectrum. It goes from anything from construction. You know, if we think of lifestyle of property, it goes from the investment from people coming up with money through to development, and there's, you know, part of that is architectural. You know, you have huge investment in modular building, the ways we build, environmental stuff in the way we build, the materials, all the way through to then actually, you know, getting that built, finding tenants, selling it on, managing, occupying, you know, maintaining, and then going through that whole cycle again of you know, updating the property and perhaps taking it down and then rebuilding. So it's quite vast, and PropTech does cover, depending on who you talk to, ConTech, construction tech, facilities management tech, and anything and everything between, including smart buildings and smart cities.
It is vast, and people, when you start thinking about all these various sectors of that, you realize just how vast it is. And I kid you not, up until 2012, I was working with an architect who still hand drew all his plans, and they really were just things of beauty. And yet CAD and things that we think of as quite early in the uptake of PropTech, that has been around for quite some time, and it's just one really small part of this very big journey. Another point that I wanted to make is, or ask you, do you think that there are a lot of, rather than taking a problem and providing a solution, there are perhaps a lot within the PropTech industry who have tried to create a solution to a problem that doesn't necessarily exist? And is this something that you do see a bit of?
Absolutely. There's a lot of that out there, and it's no different to any other industry where, you know, for various reasons, the vast majority of people who start up a business won't unfortunately make it through. But there's definitely a lot of solutions to problems that don't exist. And there's a lot of people, you know, very, very focused on a particular problem being solved, which actually might be a problem for them or a small amount of people, but isn't necessarily a problem with the wider world. I would say though that on the whole, that changes to some degree, because I remember, you know, back in the day when we were selling software solutions to the industry, and you know, the process, we were selling enterprise solutions, so we were selling to big firms, but there's still a massive part of the process was education. You know, you'd go to people and have to try and convince them that they had an issue, and these were real solutions to real problems, but yet you still have to educate the industry and say, look, you know, this will really make your life easier, this is your problem, this is how you can help it. And generally it was very much you know, all about efficiencies, trying to prove ROI on efficiencies and just making people's lives better, but we still had to educate them. And I think that that part of the process is slowly going away. I think the industry has obviously picked up now and said, look, you know, we get it, technology can help us. You know, we're moving from this kind of tech Luddite industry into an industry where tech is becoming more mainstream. So there's less education going on, but there's still a lot of solutions out there that you know are either you know, solutions to problems that don't exist, or they're just sledgehammers to crack a nut. So there's definitely a lot of that going on.
With just picking up on the point you made about things becoming more mainstream, I think that as someone who's very much down the size scale as far as the developments I do are very small relative to the big house builders. But what we find is we need these bigger house builders to be the first adopters of the new technology and then allow it to become more mainstream, and that then brings prices down and means that it's cheap enough for the smaller developers to access. So take, for example, the modular housing. It used to be, not so much now, but it was so expensive and so cost limiting for a smaller developer to do that we just couldn't even consider it. But now that, say, Legal & General and some other really big companies have backed that, it's brought the efficiencies in and the costs down so people can adopt that. There's this timeline, isn't there? And what do you think that timeline is? Obviously, it depends on the subsector, but generally, what do you see as the lag?
Yeah, it does depend on the sector. And I think for things like, you know, as you mentioned, modular housing, where there's such a huge amount of investment coming through, and it takes so long to develop, and you know, there's so many challenges with getting something like that to market, then absolutely it's still going to be, you know, the bigger guys who are taking their time over it and who are working on the development, putting their bucks behind it. So I think things like that will still take a long time until they get down to the smaller companies. And you know, when you go to your local B&Q or wherever it is that people go to start getting materials, or Travis Perkins, others do exist, wherever you go to get the materials, you know, you're still not going to find modular housing stuff as mainstream. It's still a way off yet. That said, on the software side of things, where there isn't a huge amount of outlay, it's software as a service. You know, people, agents, you know, small mom and pop shops, they can literally just pay a few bucks a month and find software that really works for them, just makes their life easier, integrates with things like financial packages that are out there, the Xeros, the QuickBooks, some of those smaller packages. So I would say the software is certainly easier to become mainstream than some of the big hardware and modular type stuff. You know, construction, for example, a lot of it is VR, a lot of it is actually equipment being used to make the whole process easier. So really good tech, but it's still expensive to actually go out there and you know, design, develop, manufacture, and still make it affordable. But certainly on the software, anything that's kind of more about the systems rather than the hard tech is generally going to be much quicker to
Absolutely. And things that you can get on your phone, so that limits the barrier to entry. You don't have to have standalone systems or standalone handheld VR goggles, things like that, that just add to the cost and perhaps prohibit entry.
And I think you have to distinguish hugely between what it is as well and the ROI on that. So there's loads out there, for example, and this goes down to society and you know the way the world works. And I'm a big believer in the world works in cycles. Some, you know, there could be 20-year cycles of when the world is all about, you know, sharing and giving, and it's the kind of we world. And then you have cycles of I world, where it becomes very much back to, you know, what's in it for me and that kind of stuff. And I think when we look at the world generally, you know, we can see that where people are trying to do things, it could be things like tenant engagement, it could be things like environmental type stuff, which is, there's no real ROI, there's no saving, but people do it for altruistic reasons. They actually believe in it, or they want to provide a better service. Those are harder to adopt, particularly in areas, for example, like property management, where people would love to have, you know, better tenant engagement. They'd love to do stuff in a much more environmental way and, you know, look at the social aspects and give back. But actually, margins in management and sometimes in construction and sometimes in facilities management are really, really small, and they just can't afford to take on, you know, different costs. Whereas when you're looking at other parts of the industry where, you know, this is all about efficiencies, it's nothing social, it's nothing to do with the environment. This is actually, I've got five people in office, I can reduce them to one, deploy them elsewhere or save costs, those are going to be adopted much, much quicker.
Can we turn to data, or data, however you'd like to say it? It seems to be, perhaps this is going back a couple of years, but it seemed to be that you would have these prop tech companies come up with a solution to a problem, and then all of a sudden they realized that they had captured so much information. And so then, of course, it became all about the data. And then companies popped up which were just about data, the mining of it, and then the interpretation of it and the presentation of that, and implementing the information that you find off the back of that. Do you think that a lot of these companies were perhaps a little overdone in their valuations, or were they serving a purpose? What's your view on the whole data side?
So I'm a big believer in data, and I think they absolutely serve a purpose. And the way I like to look at it is, you can take an example of traditional ownership as a landlord of a property. And up until, you know, recently, they had two options really open to them. You've got a property, you've got a potential tenant, I can either give you more space, or I can lower the cost per square foot, per square meter. Those are the two variables that you've got. And that's the way the whole world worked. You know, those are the two things. I've got space, you've got money, we'll work something out. And if you don't have enough money, you get less space. If you want more space, it costs you more money. And that's all there was to it. And this isn't necessarily, you know, where you know, the data pushing this, but what data supports is the fact that the world has changed, where people are saying, well, actually, it's not just about space, how much of it I've got and the price per space, but actually, even before we've built this thing, I can use data to say, well, okay, I've got a plot of land, who's going to be attracted to this plot of land, be it location, you know, what kind of tenant? Great, okay, I know this is going to be industrial, or I know this is you know, going to be a superstore, they're most likely to take it. Great, what does a superstore need? I go back to my data. Well, you know, superstores value, you know, better data connections, or better, you know, better retail tech, whatever it is that they need. And then you start to develop and build accordingly. So you've gone from variables of, I've got a property, this amount of space at this price, to actually saying, okay, what am I going to do to this property to make it really appeal to the right kind of tenant that I want to maximize the price? And it could be putting in decent Wi-Fi connections. It could be environmentally friendly. It could be, you know, it could be meeting rooms and sensors, and it could be, you know, better areas of water. It could be all these sorts of things that new tech advances support. But we've gone from actually just saying, I don't know anything about the tenants, or I don't know anything about the property, all I know is I've got the space, to actually saying this massive data can actually help me really maximize the investment, maximize the income. And I think that's where data has become really huge. People have kind of clocked and said, well, if I actually look at the data properly, I've got a lot more opportunity open to me on this particular property. And I think that's just an example, but it goes through the whole cycle of the property. So, you know, when you're looking to develop, what do I want to develop? Well, let's look at what the data supports. You know, if I'm in the middle of a town and I've got an empty property, what do I want to turn it into? Well, let's look at the data and see who's likely to take this kind of place and what does that need? You know, do I want a cheap phone line? Do I want, you know, huge, you know, proper, decent connectivity in there? Great. You know, do I want to spend money on environmentally friendly stuff, or is it not worth my while? Well, let's have a look at the data. And that's where I think the data has crept in. So there's a huge value in data. But I think it's only more recently that you know, the investors in the property world have actually started to take note and say, actually, this data could be really helpful.
That's right. It helps us shape decisions and right, and also support decisions, because that's also an important part of this when you've got stakeholders that you need to either convince or reassure. Speaking of reassurance in sort of more uncertain times, are there any trends that you're seeing emerging here in a pandemic and that you think will continue post-pandemic?
Yeah, there are. I think firstly, it's worth noting that the real estate tech space as a whole, from an investment perspective and from an ownership perspective of businesses, is actually been really resilient. So whilst other industries have taken a dip within, during COVID and have been hard hit, there are various areas of the prop tech industry that have actually really, really boomed. You know, things like retail tech, which also falls into prop tech. So, you know, being able to look at footfall, being able to look at identifying people who come into stores and that kind of stuff, and placement of products. But all of that still falls in some way to prop tech. But obviously retail has probably taken a hit because all the retail industry has taken a hit. Construction in some respects, possibly also. But then you take a look at things like the return to work. So office tech, you know, smart buildings, and I'm actually understanding how my office is used. So again, beforehand, people had loads of, offices with X amount of meeting rooms, X amount of open space. Now they're saying, well, okay, let's understand who's going to come back to the office.
Yeah.
What does that mean for the office space? You know, some people will say, well, everyone's going to take 80% less space. I think people will actually take the same amount of space, but they'll want to look at configuring it differently. I know that rather than people being every day in an office, we're actually going to have less people coming in the whole time. But when they do, they want to collaborate. So actually, I need the same amount of space, but I don't need desks. I need, you know, meeting rooms. I need, you know, big open spaces, cafeteria spaces. So I think, you know, understanding how offices are being used has been really big. And people who've got solutions around workplace tech, the return to work, so it could be things like access control, things that mean I don't have to talk to somebody, I don't have to be near somebody, I don't have to punch in buttons that need to be wiped the whole time. So anything that is kind of hands-free or contact-free in and around the workplace has become really big. The ability to for people to work remotely, again, not strictly prop tech, but you know, the understanding that people are going to be working remotely to a much higher degree. What does that mean in terms of the office? So workplace tech, office tech has become really, really big. People still need to move into houses, whether it's rental properties, people still need to buy properties. So that whole process of actually having an agent engage with a potential tenant or in the buying or selling process, ways to do that, again, contactless and particularly in lockdown when people can't even move around. So things like, online viewings, VR, AR, that kind of stuff is really seen an uptake. So I think trend-wise is definitely around workplace, is definitely around contact-free access, having to engage with people directly less. Those are definitely areas that I think we're going to see going forward. People talk about specific trends such as AI, and there's been a bit of a boom in AI. I think you can just apply that to every area of the industry. So, you know, the areas that the industries that are going to be booming, AI is going to, going to make a big difference there. But that to me just falls back down to how can I do things more efficiently, and better. So without focusing on the particular technologies, I think the workplace tech, you know, getting people moving in into houses, those kind of things are easier. And then just because people are strapped for cash, anything that makes things more efficient and save costs is always going to be a winner.
Yeah, that's right. And you and I think, are perfect examples of, I've had my children walk in and start printing, and you've got children in the background. And I think that this, all this talk about people not wanting to return to office, the office, is probably a little bit premature and over-egged, because I do see, just from, just anecdotally from the people I'm speaking to, people are desperate to get back into the office and collaborate properly. So I don't think there'll be any less demand for that. With them, you've talked about trends, so you've obviously answered my question a little bit, but is there any particular subsector of prop tech that really excites you right now?
That's a good question. I think the whole IoT space, to me, is quite exciting. So, and again, this goes mainly back to either offices or to home, but the ability for things connecting. So whether it's being able to manage your lighting, you know, when you're from home, your heating, understand what's going on in your home room, remote control that. Things like safety as well, be the safety of people's understanding, you know, we have a problem. Certainly the UK's had a problem, but I'm sure there are other parts of the world where, unfortunately, you know, older people particularly who don't have that much contact with the outside world, suffering inside their houses and people don't know. So there's tech out there, whether it's, you know, IoT, sensors, monitors, that actually understand what's happening in the space for safety reasons, from an insurance perspective, leak detection things. I think anything in IoT that kind of tells you what's happening in a building, being able to control a building, and again, from the officer's perspective, you know, understanding how those are used, because I think it's going to take a lot of time till we really understand, you know, the difference in the office space. And you talk about people wanting to come back to work. I think it's, at the end of the day, I don't think you could put a number on it. It comes down to choice. Some people prefer to be out. Some people prefer to be at home. Some people to have a mixture of home and office. I'm a people person, you know, I'd always much rather work in an office environment than a home environment. But I think it's going to take us a while till we actually understand what that means. So again, anything that helps us understand how offices are used, you know, whether it's, you know, how many desks are being used, how many meeting rooms, you know, what kind of lighting consumption do I need? All of that, I think, is really exciting. And then the big one that's coming up is, which did come up and about 5 years ago, and then it kind of went a little bit quiet as I think people's focus has changed, but it's come up you know, quite strongly. And as I'm saying that, I'm thinking this might be, to keep politics out of it, but it might be a Trump, non-Trump effect. But I think the whole environmental aspect of property built world is by far obviously the biggest contributor to environmental issues, and we saw a lot of that a few years ago. People started talking about you know, whether it's monitoring your energy or doing things in a more environmentally friendly way, ESG as a whole, really. But to me, it felt like it kind of went a bit quiet, and I think some people said, oh, that was just a fad, that was just you know, which is a bit trendy, but it's come back full force now. And I think you know, there's absolutely, you look at some of the investment that's going in, people are looking at you know, investment with a mandate purely to look at things that are better environmentally, and I think that's certainly quite an interesting space. You know, I'll hold my hands up, you know, I'm not one of the people who's generally been, you know, banging the drum about environmentally friendly type stuff, and my general view of the world was, well, look, let's do what we can, but let's not go crazy you know, about the environmentally green stuff. But you know, the more and more you think about it, and the more and more that you see that we can actually make a difference, you know, I think that's a really hot space to be in, and I think there's a lot of money pouring into that tech, and I think there's a lot of people working hard to come up with solutions for that as it relates to property.
The news today on the BBC headlines, we're in mid-Jan, is that the current large office buildings are still using it 80 to 90% of their energy consumption because of this requirement to keep their HVAC systems running, even though they're empty. So clearly we've still got quite a long way to go on that, and on the consumption of energy and the energy requirements that office blocks have, even when they are empty, and that's perhaps something that needs to be looked at. And yeah, it was interestingly,
Yeah, I mean, so we all know, you know, you could walk down the big cities in the middle of the night and just find huge, tall skyscrapers with lights on almost every floor. And that's just a small part. And again, you know, I need educating in that area as well. You know, I've never dismissed it. I've never been one of these people who said, look, it's not happening, climate change. And it's I've always acknowledged it certainly is happening, but I was taking a view of, okay, we do what we can. Let's try and reuse the plastic bags wherever possible, but let's not go crazy. But I think, you know, even someone like myself is actually saying, hang on a minute, we've got to do more than that. And you know, that we've got to look at ways that the biggest asset class in the world, of which I'm a part of, contributes, and we need to get better at doing things. And I think there's a lot of people out there working hard at that. So for me, that's quite an interesting space. Not that I know much about it, but it's an interesting space. And it's something that we'll definitely be delving into more.
Yeah, and ESG is a huge space, as you say, and that's led by customer demand. And as people demand more ethical investments, then more companies are going to have to step up and say that they're ethical. But there's still a lot of question marks around what is ethical, because some ESG funds invest in Facebook. Yeah. Now you might say, well, how's that an ethical investment? So it's all down to definition and what your definition is. And if it's that you don't invest in, say, tobacco, alcohol, and arms, perhaps that's your definition, but it's about finding the investments that meet your own criteria. And I think people are becoming a lot more aware of that.
But I think that becomes quite dangerous, you know, as well, with the whole cancel culture. You know, you can find things, yeah. You can find ways now to upset anybody and everybody. So yeah. It is really hard to understand, okay, you know, where do you draw the line, okay, as yeah. to what is okay and what isn't okay. But I think there's definitely been a shift from, you know, people doing stuff because it made sense to commercially, to actually people saying, do you know what, we have a responsibility, and whether it costs us money or not, we're going to do X, Y, Z. So I think we're definitely seeing more of that, you know, where people are actually doing things for the right reasons, not just because, oh, it's a great tick in the box, which means I'll win more clients. So there is kind of a, you know, there's even within the big corporates, there seems to be a lot of kind of personal, you know, at the highest level, it seems to be a bit of a personal reason for people saying, do you know what? We really need to be more responsible, which is good to see. It's absolutely good to see. But again, it does cost money, you know, and I think that's really where we're going to be testing ourselves, really, is, okay, we know it has to be done. We know it's expensive. We know it's going to take a while. But, you know, how much are we really willing to invest in that? And that's where I think we'll see the change. I think more and more people are actually going to invest in it, rather than just say, oh, yeah, I'll do it because, you know, people tell me it's the right thing to do.
It's the right thing. Yeah, and 1% of change can make a huge difference over time. Just to, looking at your LinkedIn, and clearly you really do contribute so much to this sector with the advisory boards that you sit on and the numerous companies that you work with. One of those is PiLabs, and they're just synonymous with prop tech success stories. What do you think is their secret ingredient, and why is it that they produce so many successful companies?
First of all, PiLabs are one of the first in the VC space in the UK and Europe with a particular focus on prop tech. So there's definitely something for you know, being one of the early ones to the table.
And they're an incubator, aren't they? Is that right?
They have a venture arm where they're just investing things as a VC. But yeah, they have they have incubator programs. They've got accelerator initiatives. They do quite a lot to actually support very early stage growth in prop tech. I think they've had success because, you know, they were, as I say, they were one of the first to do it. They also did it in a very broad way. So, you know, without trying to be very specific, is we'll only invest in commercial that looks like this, and there's, you know, it's got X amount of revenues at this stage. They took a very broad view on early stage businesses, and, you know, it could be people from just basic ideas that they'll help get together, or actually things that could be a little way down the line as well. And it could be anything from residential, commercial, you know, just a service, more tech enabled, less tech enabled. There was a tech focus, but, you know, they allowed it to be so broad that they managed to obviously capture loads and loads. I think their cohort was probably what, the eighth, ninth cohort potentially of companies they're invested in. You know, the guy behind it, Faisal, you know, he's a real entrepreneur. He's been in the real estate investment space for a while. So, you know, he's had a decent view. you know, Dominic, who used to run it, who left not that long ago, you know, was somebody who knew the space back to front. So a mixture of having good people, as well as being one of the first movers and really, really taking a punt. You know, they weren't investing hundreds of thousands to these early stage companies. They might have done this on the VC arm, but, you know, the ability to drop, you know, 50K and just help people out, you know, with £1 million and you're dropping 50K, for example, that's 20 different companies and ideas that you can help. So, you know, it's a combination of different things, but they certainly built themselves up as a name. And to be honest, there's a lot of Pi Labs out there at the moment. You know, in the last 5-6+ years, throughout Europe and the US, loads and loads of VC companies have come up with a really particular focus on buildings or prop tech. But Pi Labs is definitely a name that people recognize and synonymous with really, really early stage, you know, seed ideas, rather than just investing in the companies that are already, you've got some traction. And let's be honest, the risk is always different. So it's very easy to say, you know, I'll invest in a company that's got profits and it's, you know, ready, a Series G or whatever series people come up with. You know, it's running, it works. You know, to actually saying, you know what, I'll put some money behind two blokes, you know, and a girl coming out of university who've got a half-baked idea, and you know what it would look like in 6 months' time is massively different to the idea that they had. But to be able to put money behind those is exciting, and you know, they became known for that.
Yeah, that's right. And it's great for people to have had that, I guess, that stamp of approval on their business idea that they went through Pi Labs or they were recognized by Pi Labs. Ben, thank you so much for your time today. I think that it's been incredibly insightful into a whole range of things within the prop tech industry. And it's just so vast. And clearly, there are not many people who know more about it and all the different subsectors than you. So thank you very much for your time, Ben. And lastly, where's the best place for people to get hold of you if they would like to?
Well, thank you for the comment. It's been good. It's been a fun chat and I always enjoy doing these. People can find me at learnassociates.com. Gives you a bit about me, tells you about what I do day to day. But as you said, you know, I've got a LinkedIn profile, I've got a Twitter profile. Neither of those particularly interesting, but definitely gives you a flavour for what I do and what I'm about. Try to stay out of trouble on social media generally, but you can find those ways to reach me, and definitely at ben@learnassociates.com. And you know, I certainly enjoy talking to people and I enjoy helping people wherever I can. So you know, always happy for people to get in touch and just say, look, I know that's not quite your field and what you do day to day, but do you know anything about X, Y, Z? Can you help me? And if I can, I'm always happy to.
Great. Thank you very much for your time, Ben.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please support us with a like, comment, subscribe, and share. And you can always join the conversation live across my YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages at 1 p.m. every Thursday. See you there soon.